From the Sky News Centre at 5, it's been revealed Gordon Brown asked Libya to arrange a low-key return for the Lockerbie bomber, but Abdel Basset al-Megrahi was welcomed by people waving flags in pictures that have caused anger here and in the US, where President Obama says it was his release was a mistake. PJ Crowley is from the US State Department.
The Scottish minister said that a convicted terrorist has a right to die at home, and the United States could not disagree more. But clearly, we respect laws. We respect the right, that the fact that Scottish authorities had this right.
A tourist has been killed and four others are missing after a landslide at a beach in the Algarve. Part of a cliff collapsed at the crowded resort of Maria Luisa in Albufeira. Firefighters are trying to free those trapped under rocks. It's been revealed two more British soldiers were killed as Afghanistan went to the polls. The men died in Helmand province yesterday. Their relatives have been told. Their deaths weren't linked to the election security. A third man will appear in court tomorrow, charged in connection with Britain's biggest jewellery robbery. The £40 million heist happened at Graff in London's Mayfair district. Two men have already been charged with conspiracy to rob. Cricket, England's bowlers have ripped through Australia on day two of the Ashes decider. Guy Swindles is at the Oval.
Australia now 143 for 9, still 190 runs behind England, and have lost their latest wicket. Stuart Clark unlucky to be given out caught by Alastair Cook, but still giving Swan his fourth wicket to go along with 5 from Stuart Broad. England have got a wonderful chance now of going on to wrap up victory in this Empire Ashes series and retain the trophy. Guy Swindles, Oval.
And the crowds are already gathering in Chelmsford and Staffordshire for this year's Bee Festival. Oasis, Lily Allen and Lady Gaga are amongst those taking part. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Hardiman.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225. Or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Day and African Week celebration. The African Voices Forum, in partnership with the Bristol Legacy Commission, present UNESCO Day and African Week. The event will be launched on Friday the 21st of August at 6 p.m. at Spike Island. On Wednesday the 19th of August, there will be the business surgery for all registered members from 5 till 7 p.m. at the Perion Centre. On Friday the 21st of August, we have the Glow Art Arts Exhibition from 6 till 7 p.m. at Spike Island, 133 Cumberland Road, followed by the film African Eye showing at the Watershed at 7:30 p.m. till 9 p.m. On Saturday, the 22nd of August, there will be the food show, young people's entertainment, and the interactive debate on African aid. On Sunday, the 23rd of August, there will be a cultural bonanza at Colston Hall from 2 p.m. until 7 p.m. with the fashion show and African traditional dance, and the crowning of the King and Queen of Africa, powered by Bristol Fusion Dance and African Jambo Band of Congo with his electric girls dancers. Be part of this historic event. For more information, please contact 07818 418 66. Or email billy@yahoo.co.uk. UNESCO Day and African Week celebration.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week is Junior Government Whip and the MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy. Our old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories. Then, in the second half of the show, Marina Morris takes to the streets of Bristol to find out what you think about the big story of the week, the NATO occupation of Afghanistan. Marina also has her own report on how the war in Afghanistan is being discussed in Russia. But before that, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging around about 20 degrees Celsius. In the daytime, dry but fairly cloudy with some sunny spells. Next week, averaging around about 16, that's quite a lot cooler, dry with sunny spells. At the beginning of the week, cloudier and wetter towards the end of the week. And next weekend, that's the 29th and 30th of August, averages down even further, that's down to 15 degrees Celsius in the daytime. Plenty of rain on Saturday next weekend and cloudy on Sunday. Week after next, saying round about 16 degrees Celsius. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and I'm joined this week by Kerry McCarthy, who's Member of Parliament for Bristol East. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
Now, are you actually from Bristol, Kerry?
No, not originally. I'm from Bedfordshire.
Okay, and you are a junior government whip. Now, what does that mean exactly?
It means basically you've got a team of whips that look after parliamentary business. So it's trying to make sure the government gets its political agenda through. It's mostly about you get divided up. So I would look after the MPs from the south, the backbench MPs from the southwest region, but also a couple of government departments. And I do international development and Northern Ireland. And if we've got legislation that's relating to that, it's very much about talking to people about whether they've got issues and just getting a feel for what's going on politically. And then you're the liaison between the ministers and the backbenchers.
So what did you do before you became an MP? Because you were only quite recently, weren't you?
Yeah, I was elected 2005. I was a lawyer for quite a long time, and I pretty much did everything you can do as a lawyer.
Criminal law or civil law?
I did quite a few years' worth of legal aid work. I worked at a magistrate's court, did criminal, did personal injury, did some more corporate stuff, did some banking stuff, did insolvency law. So I moved around quite a bit, and I even was the Labour Party's lawyer for a little while, for 6 months. Yeah.
So, what's the secret of getting off the back benches and into government so quickly?
I don't know. I mean, it was 4 years until I did that. I mean, I think the government is very keen to promote people that they see are perhaps as time goes on, when you've been in government for 12 years, which we have now, inevitably there's a bit of a turnover, and the party wants to sort of present a fresh face and have some of the younger ones, bringing them on, and particularly women as well. And I'd already been parliamentary private secretary to a cabinet minister, so this was the next step.
Okay, well, you're actually in the government, which means you're a little bit more privy to what's going on, and also you're not totally in recess. Well, aren't you actually quite busy at the moment? Because the rest of the MPs are sort of in recess, but you're still in the government, or part of it anyway.
Yeah, well, government ministers only would get a couple of weeks off during recess. There'll be duty ministers, and they'll still have to go down to London or be signing off on things, and there's a rota within the department, so they get a bit more time off. They're not having to be in London the whole time. As a whip, because the work I do is so connected to proceedings in Parliament, there's not much of that going on at the moment. But for any MP, I mean, some I'm sure, you know, perhaps if they've got a very safe seat, or if they've semi-lost interest in the job, will be taking the opportunity of a 12-week recess to skive. But most of us are actually in our constituencies and working as hard as ever. I'm going to see my father in Ireland for a few days over the bank holiday, and that's about it.
OK, on to you, Martin. Martin Summers is here too, our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Now, Martin, tell us about your time at the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development in the former Yugoslavia.
Well, I was the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development's East European desk officer from 1993 until 1996.
But what were you actually doing over there?
Well, I was dealing with all of the activities that CAFOD got involved in Eastern Europe. It was a new area for them, and it was a lot of it was pioneering work. But I did end up spending a lot of time in former Yugoslavia because of the interest that there was in this country. I mean, CAFOD was collecting a lot of money in the churches for help for people in former Yugoslavia, and that money had to be distributed, and I was responsible for doing that.
So you were responsible for finding out where was the best place to put the money, or what?
Effectively, yes. I mean, I would go on the ground in former Yugoslavia, mostly in Bosnia, and try to assess where we could be most useful with the resources that we had, which was fairly substantial. I mean, we collected several million pounds in this country, which were distributed through our auspices, as it were.
But for those people who don't necessarily know what it was like on the ground over there, what was it like on the ground? I mean, was it reasonably easy for you to collect information, or did you find it
very
confusing?
It was very confusing. We used to go to briefings by the British Army about where to go, and there'd be a huge kind of map on the wall, which is like a huge spider's web, And the closer you got to the war, the more complicated it became, because there weren't just three sides. There were groups within each of the three sides that were fighting each other, and also outside groups like Iranian militias and so on. So it was very complicated, and your map reading skills got very good. You knew where you were supposed to be going, and you made sure that you went there and not where you're not supposed to be going, basically.
Okay, now let's take a look at some of this week's stories. We did mention this last week as well, but it's been also a very big story this week, and that is the alleged Lockerbie bomber, or I think we can call him the Lockerbie bomber since he was convicted for it. Megrahi is now back in Libya. Martin, what are your thoughts about that? Is this a good thing, a bad thing, or what?
Well, I think there's been questions about his conviction from the very beginning. And I think what's a bit disturbing about this case is that he was making an appeal, and as a result of this démarche here, he's now going back to Libya without his appeal being pursued. And I think that the American relatives who are upset about this ought to ask themselves the question, if the appeal was pursued and he was shown to be innocent, then the people who really did it are somewhere still out there. And that's what many of the British relatives believe. And I think that this case just shows that we can't necessarily trust the state apparatus to tell us exactly the truth about what's going on in these incidents.
And what are your thoughts on this, Kerry? Because it looks as if this is something that's been organised from Scotland, and really Westminster hasn't been much involved in it.
Yeah, well, it's a devolved matter. And I think if you set up devolved institutions, you do have to accept that you've transferred power on certain things. And in this case, you know, Scotland is responsible for its own justice system. It's had a different legal system for, since ever. I think it was right that we didn't interfere in the actual decision about whether he should be released on compassionate grounds. But I think it's also right that David Miliband, I think Gordon Brown actually made representations to Libya that he shouldn't be given a hero's welcome. And David Miliband has condemned the fact. Yeah, unfortunately, making representations is one thing.
It's not necessarily
within our power to stop it happening.
Yeah, but it's difficult to know whether it's actually a hero's welcome or that they believe that he's coming back now after an injustice.
I don't know whether it's it's difficult to assess what's actually happening on the ground. I'm not sure whether it's particularly that he's been given a hero's welcome because he is seen to be an innocent that has now been released, or whether it's part of a wider agenda of being seen to have got one up on the USA in particular.
So what do you think about it? Is it an injustice? And is this a good thing that he's finally gone back to Libya?
Well, I think you have to look at it. There's two separate scenarios. One is the one that Martin said, where, you know, if this was an innocent man who was forced to drop his appeal so that he could spend the last few months of his life in freedom, then that's one scenario. And obviously there's a lot of outstanding questions about even if he was the bomber, who put him up to it. But if you put that to one side, because I think you can't really make a judgment on that now because the appeal's not happening, if you just look at it on the basis that he was convicted, it seems... You know, I'm in two minds on this, because on the one hand, the Scottish criminal justice system does allow for people to be released if they're terminally ill, and I think that's a fairly compassionate way of proceeding. But on the other hand, if you've got a crime of this magnitude and he's only served 8 years... I can understand that if I was one of the relatives of one of the victims, I would feel that he's not particularly an appropriate person to show compassion towards. And there are a lot of other people in our prison system that I think probably are more deserving of being released on compassionate grounds than him.
Okay.
On the assumption that he is guilty, which is a big if.
Now, on to our next story. And you have been named very recently the Twitter Tsar. Now, what does it mean to be the Twitter Tsar? And does this mean that you have been tweeting around Parliament more than anybody else on your on the internet and on your BlackBerry or whatever it is you use?
I suppose I do have the dubious honour of having sent more tweets than any other MP. And every now and again, I think I should probably do it a bit less. But the problem is now that I've got this reputation, most of my tweets, I probably only a few times a day actually send out the sort of things where it's generated by me, and it's me telling people what they're doing. Most of the time I'm replying to other people because I think it's important to use it to have a conversation. There's no such thing as a Twitter Tsar, and it's a Labour Party appointment, not a government appointment. I think the government appointed a head of digital engagement in February that the press dubbed a Twitter Tsar, and he's getting £160,000 a year. And I'm the Labour Party equivalent, and I'm getting precisely nil.
So do you tweet all the backbench MPs and advise them or tell them which way to vote? Is this why this has come to you?
No, there's a... No, it's the reason. I mean, it's The official title is New Media Campaign Spokesperson, so it covers a wider range. And I suppose the reason I was chosen was because, you know, I have got a website, I've got a blog, I'm on Facebook, I use Twitter, so I'm somebody that uses all the forms of new, or most of the forms of new media. I haven't braved YouTube yet, but and it's just about encouraging more people within the party to do it, to exchange ideas, to get into debates, and to be open to people having debates with you. So part of my job will be, so I mean, I've got two ministers on Twitter just by collaring them in the tea room. Well, they start talking to you about it, so then I just say, well, get your phone out, I'll show you how to do it, and they've both taken to it, you know, pretty well.
But aren't most of these tweets, as they're called, mostly about trivial things like I'm now putting on the kettle and things like this? It just seemed a bit of a waste of energy sending these little tweets around the world.
It depends. I mean, there are some people that do that, and they're incredibly tedious to follow because they will tell you every time they have a cup of tea. I don't use it for that. I use it, I mean, it's some of it is, I compare it to having a conversation with your mates in the pub, and you'll get a couple of you get into a really heated debate, and some, you know, it might be based on something you've read in the paper, so you might perhaps link to an article, has anyone seen this? So that gets the story going. Then people all chip in, but then meanwhile, two of your mates will get a bit bored with it and start talking about pies, which is what happened last night between the Labour candidate for Bristol West and a Labour MP for Manchester, where the Pieminster pies were better than I think it's pucker pies or something like that. You know, so it's you dip in and out of a conversation, but yeah, if you're just using it to tell people, you know, boring things, then it's very much you're in transmit mode and it's not very interesting.
Well, you better keep an eye on that, make sure people don't do it. Martin, what about you? Are you a Twitterer?
Not really, no. I'm behind the times. I do use the internet quite a lot to gather information. I think it's a fantastic tool. I mean, as Kerry just mentioned, being able to link to an article is a great boon, because it means that debates can move faster, because all of the backup research is there at everybody's fingertips. So if there's a dispute about a matter of fact, it can be checked almost immediately, and that means that things can move along faster. Instead of people saying tisn't, you can settle that and then move on to the substantive question.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's the thing about Twitter, is that and it sounds silly saying that something called Twitter could be in any way sort of a serious political force, but it has changed the speed of the news agenda, because it used to be that a political party or a government department would put out a press release in time for it to make the evening news and get in tomorrow morning's papers, whereas now quite often these things will appear on the websites, obviously way before they go in the next day's papers, but the whole debate changes almost immediately, because people start saying, well, hang on, somebody else said this and that's wrong, and it's just politicians have got to be much more on the ball in terms of responding to things quickly.
Okay.
Can I just add on that? That in repressive regimes or situations of political conflict, these new technologies are obviously revolutionising the way things happen, as we've seen recently in Iran. And I used to work with Solidarność in the 1980s, and they used to
have... This is in Poland,
Well, I was based in Britain, but I used to work with Polish Solidarity Campaign. And, of course, inside Poland, people would be sending samizdat, and this was literally, you know, typed notes, which were smuggled from hand to hand. I mean, modern revolutionaries, if you like, have got a lot more things at their fingertips, which states are finding difficult to control, which is why China has got a firewall and all the rest of it.
Well, I want to draw a line under our Twittering right now, and say that I also think that it's possible for some of these technologies to be manipulated. In other words, say, for example, in Iran, I remember reading a couple of stories about people from outside the country who were pretending to be inside the country, sending tweets around and actually manipulating the debate. So, anyway, moving on to a little bit of a
NHS debate on Twitter as well.
A bit of a more serious story on the NHS again now. Three top Conservatives have been calling for the National Health Service to be dismantled. Now, this is quite shocking, and we're hearing that David Cameron has countered this by saying, "Oh no, we will be looking after the National Health Service." So, which David Cameron should we believe? Should we believe his MPs and his MEP? We mentioned briefly last week this story too. I think for many people in this country, they can't understand, Kerry, why it is that the Americans have so much of a problem with our NHS.
I know, and it was... When you see some of the stuff, and again, this goes back to what Martin was saying about the power of the internet. I mean, there are all sorts of clips from Fox News being passed around, and that's why, to go back to Twitter, the whole We Love the NHS campaign on Twitter sparked off, because suddenly people realised that the insurance companies and the Republicans and people like Sarah Palin saying that NHS have death panels. Word spread very quickly to the UK, and it was great because then people who do support Obama's reforms in the US were able to see, hang on, there's a huge number of people in the UK that are spontaneously sending out messages saying, I've had a really good experience of what were they were just, you know, what was being parodied as a Stalinist health system. So, yeah, it's but to go back to what you were saying about the Conservative view on it, I mean, David Cameron was very, very slow to respond. And some of this was, it was triggered by two things. It was the Republicans and Sarah Palin and the whole Fox News thing, but also by Daniel Hannan, a Conservative MEP, a very, very right-wing Conservative MEP, criticising the NHS. And then you've had other MPs like Douglas Carswell calling it the National Sickness Service, and Michael Gove endorsing books by him, and so on. And Cameron was very slow to actually come out and say that he didn't agree with Hannan. And eventually, he's got a personal experience of using the NHS because he had a severely disabled son. So I don't doubt that his experience as an NHS user was positive. But what I would question is whether where he's coming from on an ideological basis, which is all about privatisation and believing in market forces and not wanting the state to have a big role in people's lives, whether, you know, how close he is actually to the views of people like Daniel Hannan and Michael Gove and Douglas Carswell.
So what's your thoughts on this, Martin?
Well, I think that it shows the deep divisions within the Tory party that David Cameron is trying to cover up. I think big questions about public spending and about the way in which money should be spent are going to have to be asked because of the economic crisis. And I'm coming back to Obama's, I think what the attack on Obama's health reform is entirely self-interested. It's run by the insurance companies, as Kerry was suggesting, and by Big Pharma and so on. But of course, they're also trying to influence Obama's reform. So his reform, in many ways, isn't a National Health Service reform. It's a compulsory private system. And a compulsory private system is not a free market, nor is it a planned system. It's a bit of a mess. So, if I was an American, I'd want a serious discussion about what should be done with healthcare. I'd be pushing for single payer healthcare and a state system. But I think it also reminds the Conservative Party how deeply rooted the National Health Service is in the British psyche and the British way of life. What it gives us is peace of mind when we are sick. And when I lived in Poland and my partner got cancer, that was a financial disaster as well as a human disaster. Yeah. And people don't have to worry about this. I mean, it's great for people's mental health that they know if they get ill, they are going to be looked after. And it makes a huge difference to people's quality of life, and people do value it. And I think any government which tries to change the fundamental principles of the health service will run up against that.
In The Guardian on Monday, Andrew Lansley, the shadow health secretary, the Tory was saying that actually whatever happens, the NHS mustn't be used as a political football, and whatever the Conservatives do, their plans will lead to rising standards.
I think what they're doing is they're building on some of the things that I'm afraid the Labour government has done, like PFI and hospitals and so on. They're saying that if the Labour Party can talk about PFI for building hospitals, it's perfectly okay for us to talk about PFI for building hospitals. Nevertheless, there's no PFI money because the private sector won't come forward with it anymore. So, I mean, there are fundamental questions here. I mean, I think the National Health Service is under threat by neoliberal stealth, if you like, whoever the government is, but I think that the population as a whole want the National Health Service to be a National Health Service.
Okay.
Britain is one of the few countries in the world that really has one.
Okay, let's leave the NHS for a little while and go on to another story which piqued my interest, which is David Attenborough, the famous broadcaster, is joining the campaign to curb the world's population. I find that a little bit difficult to believe, but he actually says that actually Britain really only should have, we've got to think it's something like 60 million people living in Britain, but he reckons that's twice as the number there should be. We should only have 30 million people living here. Do you think this is is it immoral to say that we should actually only have half the population we have, or is he making some serious points? Kerry, do you want to start?
I don't think it's immoral to say that. I think you then get into very difficult territory when you talk about how you're going to enforce something like that, because it's one thing to say the country would be better off if there weren't as many people, but to actually start dictating to people the size of their families and so on. And I noticed this particularly an issue in the developing world, and it's one of the things, as you improve child mortality rates, you know, in the developing world, are you going to have population and obviously, like early deaths, if you increase life expectancy and reduce the number of deaths from preventable diseases, are you going to have a population explosion then? Or will it simply mean that people will choose not to have as many people in their family because they know that all the children will survive into adulthood? I just don't see, you know, I'd hate to see us go down a sort of China policy of restricting everyone to one child. And, you know, I think everybody despairs sometimes when they see people with huge families where they can't support the families and those sort of scenarios. But even in those cases, it's very difficult for the state to step in and say, you've got 9 children, you haven't got a job, you shouldn't be allowed to have a 10th. Even though some of the sort of Daily Mail readers might want us to do that.
Martin, it's time apparently that we abandoned this crazy taboo, and that's the chairman of the Optimum Population Trust is saying.
Well, I think everybody agrees that population is one of the stress factors on our planet. But as someone with a background in economics, I have to say that this has all been dealt with by conventional economics many years ago, which is that with every mouth there is a pair of hands, and in actual fact, we've seen when societies industrialise, as Britain did 100-some-odd years ago, people naturally reduce the amount of children that they have, especially when you've put in place things like a national health service, which means they don't have to worry about... I mean, in poor countries, people often have children because they need to be sure that somebody survives to provide them with care in their old age. And you've got, once what generally happens is what's called a demographic transition. When people reach a certain level of security, they voluntarily limit the number of their children. And in fact, in the West, in many countries like Italy, they're struggling to replace the population. And immigration is the only way in which they're managing to keep the population stable.
How about even in China, in some areas, I think they'd already dropped the one-child policy in rural areas, but they're talking about dropping it across the...
I'm really puzzled about this, because I think most of the increase in population in Britain is actually due to immigration. It's not due to people having more children here.
Well, we need those immigrants to pay the taxes to pay for the National Health Service.
I don't think it's completely... If you look at how long people are living these days, you know, that's one of the major factors as well. There are maybe fewer children coming through. But then you get into the whole debate about, do we need to raise the retirement age? Because if the alternative is to leave the retirement age as it is, and you've got people that live in easily into their 90s, if not longer... You need immigrants to actually be as the hands that feed the mouth, as Martin said.
Now, I just ought to correct myself, because apparently it's not David Attenborough that said 30 million. It's actually Jonathan Porritt that said the UK population must fall to 30 million, and David Attenborough has joined this campaign anyway.
There are other countries in the world, like the Netherlands, for example, who've got much higher per people per square mile than we have, or per kilometre. Mm. And it really depends upon how wealthy you are, to be honest with you.
Well, most of the
wealthy places can sustain very, very dense populations.
And most of the people in Britain are in the cities, aren't they? We've got a very depopulated countryside, which is a historical...
You can go to Scotland and you can find as much emptiness as you like.
Well, you can go to Wiltshire and find quite a lot of emptiness in the countryside.
But then you do get onto the environment. It's one thing about the economic side, whether a country can afford to feed itself and that, but then you do have an issue about the environmental costs, don't you?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, population shouldn't be a taboo. There are probably too many people, especially wealthy people, consuming large amounts of resources. But often this discussion is a code for, can't we get rid of all these brown people who are breeding too fast? Whereas, of course, the other flip side of that is, well, can't we cut down? We're the people who consume most. Perhaps it's we that we need to cut our numbers down. But in actual fact, what we really need to do is share wealth more equitably, and so that everybody voluntarily manages their own
Well, I
doubt whether it's a real population problem so much as an economic problem and a problem of distribution of resources. Anyway, next story we're moving on to is from Press TV, which is an Iranian television site on the internet. Apparently, that one of their opposition, well, their main opposition newspaper, has been closed down by the government, and the Iranian police have been brought in to quell the protests. Now, this is something I hadn't heard about on the mainstream news, but I'm really quite concerned. The idea that that there are newspapers being forcibly closed down we have newspapers closing down in this country, like The Observer, who don't have enough money to survive, but over in Iran it's being done by force.
It is obviously a real cause for concern, although, as Martin said, it's not so easy for a repressive regime to restrict criticism these days as it was in the old days. And there's certainly in Iran, it was really useful, the information that was coming out about the elections and the fact that it was being circulated around the world. But it's very worrying what's happening there, and obviously as a government we've got to put pressure on them with our international allies to try to rectify the situation.
I've obviously, one should be concerned if people's freedom is being suppressed anywhere. I would say that this is something to be resolved by the Iranians. Outside intervention, for example, as called for by Israel, I don't think is helpful or constructive. We shouldn't be threatening these people with war. We should be giving support to the Democrats in Iran to pursue their legitimate goals.
Okay, now on to a very, hot local story. We do talk about the buses, First Bus, here quite a bit. And the local bus operators apparently are to be probed over the high prices and lack of competition. This is happening all over the country. But then we've also had a story, I think it's in the Bristol Evening Post today, which is that the bus change tickets to Bristol apparently are a rip-off. Now, what's happening is, rather than giving people money change, the bus company is increasing this First Bus, increasing this tactic, if you can call it that, of giving people bits of paper, little receipts, instead of giving them money in change. Have you actually?
I've heard of that, and I've actually criticised them for that in the past, because they, you then have to go into the city centre to get cash reimbursement, and they say, well, it's because drivers don't carry enough change with them. But if you're somebody that you've then got the cost of going into the city, apart from the inconvenience of going into the city centre, if you're the buses are expensive enough as is, and if you're doing a journey that doesn't normally take you anywhere near the city centre, to have to pay for that additional trip just because they can't get their act together to give you change, I think it's totally unfair.
Well, one of the people commenting on the Evening Post website was saying, well, that means I've got to take 3/4 of my lunch hour out to go and get my, whatever it is, pound back that First Bus owe me. What about you, Martin? Do you use the bus much?
I do a bit, yeah. Not as often as I used to.
And what do you think about this, then? The idea of getting a bit of paper rather than a pound change or 50p or whatever?
Well, that has happened to me. And, of course, what I did is I never went to cash it because I couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
I think it's typical of the profit-oriented approach which First Bus inevitably are going to
take. I mean, who is going to take out an extra hour or half an hour to go and get back 50p?
Well, an example I get, if say you're a single parent and you live somewhere out on the outskirts of Bristol, and your daily routine is you get the kids to school, you jump on a bus into, say, Cabot Circles or Broadmead, where you work in a shop, and then you've got to be back to pick the kids up from school. And if you do maybe like a 4 or 5 hour shift, you won't get a lunch break or anything. It's people like that, when actually just those little extra costs make a difference between whether it's worthwhile them being in work and not being in work. And obviously the cost of the bus fare in itself in the first place is pretty outrageous and makes a real difference in the reliability issue. And it's just all these little things the underlying problem is we don't have a bus service that is run in the interest of the people who use them. It's not run with any idea of being a public service, and we'll never get transport sorted in Bristol.
So are you going to have
public transport as a public service?
Are you going to have a word in the ear of the Transport Secretary and Gordon Brown and tell him to change things? Because, you're one of the people in the city who is actually quite close to these people and might be able to change things.
I mean, I talk about it on a regular basis with transport ministers, and we've had various transport ministers come to Bristol, and I think we've got the Secretary of State coming soon, hopefully. The Last year I was on a bill committee, the local transport bill, which strengthened the powers that local authorities have to basically re-regulate the buses on a local level so they could decide who they wanted to run bus services locally. And I've been pushing for that. I've been pushing for things like an integrated transport authority so we can take an overview of public transport in the area. So the government's put the legislative framework in place. What we need is the local authorities to really seize the bull by the horns and said, okay, because you've got to have something that you can wield as leverage over first. Because at the moment, you know, I've written to them again in the past week with Dawn Primarolo saying the fares are far too high.
But you can't ask them.
Again.
Surely you've got to tell them what to do. You can't say, please do this.
I know, exactly. But as MP, you know, they don't seem to be worried about the popularity. They don't seem to buy the argument that actually if their fares were lower, you wouldn't have buses that were virtually empty going around the city centre, which you would have thought was basic.
Well, some of them actually finish budget. In the centre, don't they? And therefore they go round and then they go back off in the other direction.
Yeah, but they don't, you know, I mean, we've tried appealing to their logic that actually you might find you run a more profitable bus service if you get more people on the buses, which you would if the fares went down.
But so it increases their margins. This is the thing, is it increases their profit margins. If they're running less buses or less frequently with more people on them, then they're...
But it doesn't if the buses are empty, and sometimes the buses are quite full, but there's certainly other bus routes where you see them and there's nobody on them because people have chosen to walk or cycle.
Well, certainly between 5 and 6 on a Friday, people listening to this maybe on their Walkman in the bus will be thinking, well, actually, this bus is absolutely jammed.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, there's a real... You've got on some routes they're jammed, and then others there's... completely logical. I was up in Brislington the other day and in the space of 10 minutes four number one buses came past me and there was probably like five people on four double deckers put together. So it just doesn't seem there's a very good sense of planning about the whole thing.
I agree with that, but of course what some people listening to this programme will say, Kerry, is that our party has been in power since 1997 and we're still fiddling around. I mean, we're actually trying to reinvent the wheel of having locally accountable public transport services, which of course is what we had before the neoliberal deregulation revolution. I lived in Oxford at that time, and I remember that there were all of these companies leapt forward to take over. But of course, eventually, it was Stagecoach became the local monopolists. Yeah. And this is why bus companies were nationalised in the 40s and the 50s, because it's a naturally monopoly.
Concept of deregulation was meant to be you bring market forces in and therefore competition will force prices down. And that works if you're talking about, you know, restaurants or clothes shops or something like that where people do pick and choose. All it meant was that companies decided, right, we're going to throw a lot of money at running a cheap service which undercuts everyone else and drives them out. And then once we've got the monopoly, we can do what we like. So I do agree with Martin. And there was, you know, these quality contracts regime have been in place for quite a long time. We introduced it in, I think, 2000, but it didn't work in practice.
But deregulation hasn't worked in the banking sector either, has it? So, I mean, the Labour Party's been in power since, 1997 now. Yes. Why hasn't something been done?
Well, I think it's arguable, you know, we'd be going down a sort of very, very long path if we start talking about the banking sector. But
I'm talking about the government stepping in and regulating rather than just sort of saying, oh, let the free market carry on.
I mean, because apart from anything else, there's the fair degree of city regulation. It just wasn't geared up to adapt to the way that the markets worked, and it wasn't global enough to work out what was happening in our transactions with the US market. But I mean, the government takes the view, because there are some bus companies that are quite popular. I think National Express in the West Midlands might be an example. I think in Brighton they've got a quality partnership with their local bus company, and it works. It has to be said that when I was on the Local Transport Bill Committee, there were three MPs on there that were all sort of virulently critical of their local bus service, and in each case it was First Group who ran the buses. So I think we do have a particular problem.
But I mean, if these franchises are being let out, isn't there a way the government can say, well, actually, you're not up to standard, so you can't take this bus route?
That's what quality contracts are about, because the franchises aren't being let out. It's not like the rail service where the government awards a contract. First, it's purely market forces that have led First to have a virtual monopoly on buses here. It's just because they came in and pushed out the competition. So there's no issue about anyone awarding them a contract. What the government has given the local authority the power to do is to say, we've decided that we are going to, in effect, have a franchise. We're going to have a contract for people to run the buses, and we want to award it to Arriva or National Express or somebody else rather than First Bus. And I just think we've, you know, how long do we keep bashing away at First Bus and criticising them before we actually say, well, you know, we know what the solution is, we're going down that path?
Well, Kerry, you're on notice. You've got 6 months or so to sort this one out. Otherwise, you won't.
Really got to do it.
Well, I think the thing is that the stronger argument is that this is a similar problem in other parts of the country. This isn't just the thing that's happening in Bristol, so it needs to be sorted out nationally. Anyway, we're going to go on to talk about Afghanistan a bit more in a minute after this.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Yes, so I'm joined by Kerry McCarthy, Bristol East MP, this week. And Kerry, I've been having a look at down at the They Work For You website about you, which is actually, I actually recommend it. What do you think? Do you ever go on that onto that site? It seems to be one of the quite good sites to find out about who your local MPs are, which way they've voted, all this sort of thing.
It makes politics more accessible. It makes politicians more accountable. Where I have taken umbrage with them in the past, if you like, is they're very selective in not just the choice of subjects where they highlight the votes, but also in the way they, I mean, the one that I particularly object to is when they talk about voting for and against a transparent parliament, which wasn't really what the vote was about at all. And it's a bit crude in its mechanisms, but it's useful as a initial introduction to the MP, I guess.
Yeah, because I've pulled out a few of the things from there. I mean, things which you voted very strongly for. At least this is what they've said.
Voted yes.
Yeah. Okay.
No,
I don't know. maybe abstaining means you're not voting at all or whatever. But anyway, maybe you can tell us now about these. First of all, you were very strongly for the smoking ban.
Yeah, that was the ban. We had a free vote, so it was nothing to do with party whips or government telling you to do anything, and actually some government ministers voted the other way, but that was for the ban on smoking in public places, which I supported.
And also you're very strongly pro-ID cards. Can you tell us in a nutshell why you think the ID cards are going to do anything useful, like stop a terrorist or something?
Well, I don't think that's particularly where it would come in useful. I don't think, I mean, if you look at the July the 7th attacks, they were all British-born citizens, they would have had ID cards.
So what's the point? What's the point of the ID card?
I just think it's useful in terms of, you know, I deal with people on a regular basis who do have trouble proving their identity because they're not within the system for one, you know, usually people that have arrived here through the refugee system. It's a useful way of collating the information that's held in various places and just meaning it's less hassle for people to where they do have to prove their identity.
So you think it's mainly for immigrants?
I think it's a thing for convenience. I don't really understand why people are, you know, the people who campaign against it on civil liberties ground, if you actually look at the limited amount of information that would be held, that's information that's in the public domain anyway.
So
you've got to get the technology right, so it doesn't mean that they can access people's medical records or anything like that.
But, so you don't think the National ID database is anything sinister? The idea of massive databases being kept on people and being shared?
No, because it's not. It might be a massive database because there's lots of people on there, but the actual amount of information on there are things that are fairly straightforward stuff and that are already held on computers somewhere else anyway.
Another couple of things that you've been very strongly for are, at least very strongly against in this case, is an investigation into the Iraq war. That's peculiar because I think most people, certainly from our vox pops we've done in the past, seem to think that it's very important that we get to the bottom of why we were in Iraq when it did seem that there were no methods of mass destruction.
I support the fact we've got an inquiry and I support the fact that's going
on. But why did you vote against it?
Because that was a vote about 3 years ago, and there was quite a lot of us took the view that we shouldn't have an inquiry until the troops had come home. And that was always my view, is that as soon as we weren't actively involved in operations in Iraq, the inquiry should start, but it would undermine our effort then and be a distraction from our effort then. So that's why I'm saying that They Work For You site is a bit annoying the way it portrays things, because I didn't vote against the inquiry that's going on now. I voted, there was an Opposition Day motion from one of the other parties several years ago, and I think it might have come up twice, but what happens when you get those debates is you have a motion saying we want an inquiry now. You have a government motion that says we support the idea of an inquiry, but we think it should happen at a future date when the troops are withdrawn. So I voted for the second one. So I didn't actually, you know, I voted for an inquiry, just a different inquiry to the one that they're talking about.
Okay, and finally, what they're saying on this website, you can tell us whether this is true or not, is that you voted very strongly for the replacing of the Trident nuclear missile system. Now, what do we need that for these days? I mean, that's extremely expensive, isn't it? It's massively expensive.
That vote was on whether... there's going to be another vote on whether we actually go totally ahead with the replacement for Trident. This was on whether they should start doing some of the preparatory work. It comes down to whether you're a unilateralist or a multilateralist. And, you know, I'm all in favour of pushing decommissioning and, you know, as many... On a multilateral level, I think it's really good that the US have now signed up to that. And the more that we can push disarmament on a multilateral level, the better. But are we in a position at the moment where we don't need a nuclear deterrent? And I'm just not quite sure that we've reached that stage yet. But Trident, yeah, that doesn't mean that Trident will necessarily go ahead. It just means that we had to make a decision as to whether we started work now to... If we didn't start doing something now, we would be in a position where Trident couldn't go ahead at all.
But do you think we need to replace it or not?
The thing is, the difficulty is you don't really know what the threat is that is going to be facing us in 10 years' time. So people could say, we needed a nuclear deterrent during the Cold War period when you had two superpowers at each other's throats. The Cold War is over. But do you say... Well, that means there's never going to be a nuclear threat from anybody.
But does that mean, what do you think?
Into the future and say, well, potentially Iran or Israel or Pakistan or India or whatever.
Well, what about the argument that actually having it could make you be more threatened? You know, if you've got these sort of weapons, couldn't it actually make other people threaten us? Or do you think that doesn't hold any water?
I don't see that would be the case. I mean, if you look since the Second World War, the nuclear deterrent, you could argue... acted as a deterrent, and there's with the danger of rogue states getting nuclear weapons. But like I said, you know, I think it should be a minimal nuclear deterrent. We don't need, you know, we don't need enough warheads to kill everybody on the entire planet 20
okay,
times
well,
over.
Maybe we can just polish up the old ones and get the rust off them or something. Anyway, Marina Morris is here, and on the military theme, she's been looking at how the Afghanistan occupation is going down in Russia. Hi, Marina.
Hello, Tony. Hello. 20 years ago, Russian troops left Afghanistan. They were from 1979 to 1989, started when the Afghan's Marxist government repeatedly asked for help from Soviet forces. They requested Soviet troops to provide security and to assist in the fight against the Mujahideen rebels. Russia's final senior commander in Afghanistan, General Gromov, said after the pullout, "We had to help the government of Afghanistan regulate the political situation. And we have done that." The civil war continued in Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal, and its government survived for a further 3 years. The Soviet Union lost an estimated 15,000 soldiers. 500,000 soldiers served in Afghanistan. It cost the Soviet Union $800 million a year. This a further $3 billion to fund the army a year. A Russian website, quote, Professor Kramer of Harvard University published estimates of Afghan casualties as 2.5 million civilians dead or seriously wounded, and a further 1 million people left the country as refugees during the conflict. These numbers are, however, disputed other sources, quote, 5 million plus refugees fleeing to Pakistan or Iran, this a further 2 million displaced within their own country. This 4.2 million Afghans maimed or seriously wounded. Whatever the numbers, the orphans and displaced provide a fertile recurring ground for insurgents in the current conflict. As a part of its Cold War anti-Russian strategy, the United States, Saudi Arabia, Britain, Pakistan, Egypt, China, and others provided military support to the Afghans' anti-governmental rebels. Great trade for the world's arms dealers supported by governments, but many of these arms and munitions are now killing NATO troops. Russia is now assisting the NATO deployment but by allowing supply flights to cross its airspace. The current war can be seen at least in part as a legacy of Russian conflict without a clear end in sight. The protagonists have changed, but the loss and grief of the world's refugees, orphans, widows, and the parents of the dead remains universal. The war in Afghanistan increases the world tragedy. Can we solve any of problem of this region?
Okay, Marina, thanks very much. Interesting to hear some of those figures of the civilian casualties compared to our 200 soldiers that have died. Anyway, expelled Afghanistan MP Malalai Joya really is said to be one of the bravest women in the country, and not without justification. She told a 300-strong audience at Conway Hall in central London that she survived five assassination attempts and is still not safe with personal security guards or by wearing a burqa to cover her identity. Yet she continues to campaign against foreign occupation and fundamentalist warlords alike, and for women's rights and education. She believes all NATO troops must leave Afghanistan immediately.
Many democratic-minded, some democrat parties we have, more than democrat parties, democrat intellectuals we have, but there is no honest job for them. Government do not support them. My case itself should be an example. Why they expel me from parliament? Because I exposed their mask inside of the National House. I said this parliament... I said this parliament is worse than animal stable. It's like zoo. I divided parliamentarians into two parts. First part are few Democrat men and women who are in the parliament. Unfortunately, we are in minority. And majority seats belongs to warlords, drug lords, criminals. Only one example I'm telling you is enough to know about this disgusting parliament. In the beginning of parliament, they made amnesty law. Criminals forgive themselves, which is so ridiculous. And even people raise their voice against this Injustice Act. This is the right of the victims to forgive the criminals or not, but who listen to the voice of my people? And now for thousands of times, this parliament showed that this is non-democratic parliament, that they made a kind of law against Shia's women of my country, while Shia and women, both of them, do not have even human life, most of them in faraway provinces of my country especially. Only with this kind of disgusting laws, they make legal their crimes. And Hamid Karzai, this puppet man, has to compromise with them, even signed this disgusting bill. Anyway, it was quite a legal act, and I don't want to talk more about that, but if I want to go back to the parliament, as I have defense lawyer, the last answer of the parliament, the complaining commission of parliament to my defense lawyer 3 months before was that we didn't punish her as we wished. We must punish her with Kalashnikov. Inside of National House, they talk with the language of Kalashnikov.
Well, that's pretty frightening, talking about punishing an MP with a Kalashnikov. And let's hope that the new parliament, which comes about after the elections this week. Martin, what do you think the prospects are for things improving over there? Because it seems even the democratic parliament it certainly doesn't live up to the democratic standards we have over here even.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. We've just been beating up Iran for not having a legitimate election, and there's been questions about vote rigging and fraud and so on. And of course, all of those questions are going to be raised in relation to this election in Afghanistan. The other factor is that the Taliban have not been allowed to stand in these elections, and perhaps didn't even want to stand. This reminds me of previous situations we've seen in Ireland or in Rhodesia, as it then was, where you have what's called an internal settlement, where the only people allowed to stand are those who are not fighting you. And the lesson of all of these conflicts, and in Chechnya included, is that you have to bring all political forces into a political solution. And I noticed that the British Foreign Secretary has been suggesting this. It's very hard to explain to the British public why we should be fighting people that we're also planning to talk to. Can't we just talk to them and cut the fighting?
Yeah. It is a tricky situation. I mean, I was an election observer in the last elections in the West Bank. And, of course, that resulted in a Hamas victory. And you immediately had some people saying, we're not prepared to talk to Hamas because of their links with terrorism. My view has always been that you need a dialogue, as, you know, we would never have reached a peace agreement in Northern Ireland without talking to people that perhaps had involvement in terrorist activities in the past. It's a bit more difficult with the Taliban because their views are so rigid that it's not so easy to see whether you'd be able to move them any distance at all if you brought them to the negotiating table. But I think the ideal scenario would be that you had a stable, democratically elected regime in Afghanistan that had a big enough army and was well-resourced enough to deal with the problems on its own doorstep with the Taliban. We're far from being in that situation. And I, reluctantly, because obviously, the British casualties are dreadful and the civilian casualties there are dreadful too. Reluctantly, my view is that we still have a job of work to do to try to ameliorate the situation. And just because you haven't won the war there, just because there are difficulties, doesn't mean to say that you're not actually doing some good by being there.
Okay, anyway, Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol again this week, and she's been finding out what you think about the British government's commitment to Afghanistan.
Should our troops be in Afghanistan?
No, I don't think we should be in Afghanistan, no. But what I find really offensive about the whole thing, really, in terms of what we get in the public and from the point of view of the media, is that we hear all the time about the soldiers who've died, and of course I'm concerned about them, but we very, very rarely hear about the civilians who die over there, people who actually live there, and that really, really, really sickens me. And I find it really hard to, I just want to turn the radio off when I hear about it, because it's so imbalanced, the reporting is so imbalanced. And I think if more people knew about what was actually going on the ground, and people, how suffering there really is over there, I think people would think, think a bit more about whether it's such a good idea to be over there in the first place.
I don't personally think we've got a lot of justification for being in Afghanistan, to be honest. I don't think that the government really gave the public the impression that they really knew why they were there, to be honest. And I think our efforts, I don't see why the UK and the US act like the world police, really, and think that they can decide who does what elsewhere around the world, basically.
Well, should we be there? I think we should be in Afghanistan, yeah. Well, because our policy is to help people out, isn't it, really? We might not be doing the best job at the moment, but we're definitely over there trying to help people out and help the situation over there. So I think we should be there. And I think maybe we might not be going about it the right way, but I definitely think we should be over there. I know, it's a long time, yeah, but the thing is, like the army, a lot of things about the army now is about how much it's costing you. It's like 200, over 200 people this year have died and all that sort of stuff. Well, that's what the army they're for, They go into it, like my sister's in the army and my other sister was in the Navy, so they know full well that if they go to Afghanistan, they're going to die. So they're aware of this fact, That's what the military's there for. It's a part of their life and a part of their job, really. So they are aware of that, and I think that even though it does cost lives, at the end of it, if we can sort everything out, then it'll be a price well paid, really.
I don't think we should be over there, but I think because our soldiers are over there, I think we should support them, because I think what they do is a good cause, and I don't like the fact that people give them negative, sort of, when they come back and stuff, people, I don't know, boo them or whatever. I think that's disgusting. I think people like that should go to prison. So I support our soldiers, but I feel sorry that they're all losing their lives for something which isn't anything to do with us.
All I know is I don't think they should be there, but there again, that's just my opinion.
What sense is that? Why are they out there?
Not achieving anything.
No. Why are we fighting?
I don't really know anymore, because I mean we've done it before and we're doing it again. I think we've all lost the plot, really. So, I don't think most people really know what we're there for. So yeah, perhaps we need to be told again and then we can make up our minds.
I think it's probably based around oil and weapons contracts, if I was going to be cynical about it, I think. But it's just, I've always had a problem with the fact that the US and the UK have nuclear weapons, but we make sure that no other country can, so I don't understand how we can sort of dictate that to other people, really.
Well, I think the war is generally about, it's more, I don't know, like the war on the right was more about the oil, I think, as opposed to any weapons of mass destruction. That's a bit gone wrong. I think the Afghanistan, it's trying to, the whole terror thing is trying to make the world a safer place, and it's more about protecting us back here. And that's the reason. Although, like I said, we might not be going about it the right way, really. We should be doing it more peacefully at the same time, but at least we are trying. So that's what I believe.
Exactly. I didn't really know. I didn't know what the war was over, really. I know what Iraq's over, but I didn't know why we're in Afghanistan.
Can we win this war?
Well, I think, as usual, the main oppressors will win, won't they? The Americans will win, the British will win. I mean, I don't think there's anyone on the ground's going to win. I think it's all just playing games, really.
I don't know. I think that it's been going on for so long now, I don't think it's something that's going to be very clear-cut. I think it will either go on for the foreseeable future with a lot more people dying, or we should just pull out and leave them to it, really, basically.
Who's going to win? I don't think we'll see. I don't think we'll win for a while, personally. I think it's going to take a while, so I don't really know who's going to win. Hopefully we'll win, and hopefully the people will win, because obviously it must be really rubbish for them over there, you know, having to deal with this on a day-to-day basis. But fingers crossed, it'll be done shortly, so that things can get back to normal for them.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about that? What are we doing over there?
I think that it's quite clear that between 55 and 59% of the British people want British troops out by Christmas. That is what the opinion polls say. I think that's a problem for mainstream politicians like Kerry here, who want to keep us in there.
I'm not
one of those who believes that we should
stay. So what are we doing over there, Kerry?
I think it's partly about supporting a regime in Afghanistan which is trying to do the best of its people and combat some of the horrible scenarios you saw when the Taliban were in charge, but also the global security issue is, of course, very important. And yeah, we do have a duty as a government to protect our citizens, as does the American government, from potential terrorism.
I'm sorry,
threats.
I have to stop you there. That's all we've got time for this week. Please join us again at 5 p.m. next week for Friday Drive Time. My guest has been Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for Bristol East.